Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
G'day, Annie McLaughlin here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, workers' stories and social justice issues. This program is produced in Melbourne for 3CR and the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Radio Foundation on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Today's program looks at OH&S, workplace safety, from a number of angles. Up close and personal, the broad lens of the class struggle, and finally, the importance of unions in that struggle. We go first to the most recent edition of Fire Up Plumbers Show on 3CR, where they report on a trench collapse at a site in the western suburbs of Melbourne last week.
Wazza. Obviously, different story for you, my friend. There's been a bit going on in your world. You had to go and attend something.
Yeah, a bit of everything happening, to be honest with you. Last week, when Johnny and Herc were off doing the country run, we had a pretty serious incident out in the west on a job on a factory where we had a trench collapse. So the wall gave way. They pulled the shields out a little bit early in the backfill and getting the whacker out the way, and the wall gave way and landed on the bloke, and a few broken ribs and some stitches, and you know, he got off pretty lightly, because reality is if a bit more had gone, he would have been in a lot more trouble. So he was able to crawl himself to a safer spot and let the wait for the emergency services to come and build some soldier sets and strap him up and take him out, you know, horizontally. So he wasn't in a good way. He's pretty lucky, and everyone's lucky that it wasn't worse than it was, but that was, you know, 2 days out there going through the processes, seeing what went wrong, why it went wrong, how it can not happen again, make sure it doesn't happen again. And to be honest with you, the employer was great, had a great response. They stopped works of that nature across all their projects until they could rewrite their swims, reinduct everyone into it, change the process, reiterate it, put a few more permits and things in place that you have to have done before you can pull shields out, and even to the number of people working in the crew. So,
well, that's the whole idea of swims, isn't it? Was to obviously improve them, and something fails, a procedure, when, policy,
you know,
whatever.
When you hear of people that are working outside the swims or choosing to ignore it or think they know more, when you see how bad it can go, you know. Just talking about the bloke who thinks it's safe to work in 100 mile an hour winds. Well, work to your swims, and even then, if it's not right and it's not safe, they're not set in stone. It's not the Ten Commandments. You can adapt, you can change, you can amend, sign back into them, retrain everyone on them.
Well, that's where you ring an organiser if worse comes to worse, and let us know what's going on.
It's not hard. If it's not right, it's not right. No one should have to go to work in unsafe conditions. And we're seeing this rise of generic swims getting around, and people thinking it's all right to just blob the same swims on every job, but not every job's the same.
The ChatGPT for swims, man, it's a disgrace, really. I think with all of us on it, I was thinking about after you had that trench collapse, was that me as an apprentice, some of the things I did as a first year when I was working domestic, and some of the pressure points I got put in. Guys, if you're in that situation, just send us a text, give us a call. It's unacceptable. And if you think something's wrong, it generally is wrong.
If you feel, you know, you get that feeling in your gut that this isn't right, typically that feeling is correct. So,
that's right. And that's where people die, mate.
I'd rather get the sack and walk off a job than go to work under pressure and get hurt or worse.
We end up in a coffin box.
You know, there's no boss out there that's going to willingly tell you to go and do something unsafe. So if they do, they're in all sorts of strife. So
that's right. We'll come
give us a call. We'll come out. We'll assess the situation for you. So, yeah, it was pretty serious last week. You know, Johnny came out the second day, and we we had a member willingly put their hand up to go on all the safety walks, good, represent all the boys on, and girls, yep, on site. So, well, yeah, empowering people to speak up, that's what it's all about, you know. So, and I don't think anyone was going to push back after such a serious incident. So it was good to see the bloke put his hand up.
And you got John Mancini out there for the CFMU. He's taken on the role full time. And he's a frigging ripper, mate.
There wasn't anyone there from any of us. There is now, and John,
mate,
John went out there on the day of the incident, and he's been an absolute ripper since. So
he signed me up more members than anyone last year. He's a ripper. He cares for the plumbers. Not that it's just about membership, but he really cares about everyone on site. Had more barbecues than I could think of, throw a stick at. He's a champion, John, so it's good. The members
are they're our brothers at the end of the day. That's why we've got the BIG, the building industry groups. We all stick together.
He looks after everyone like it's like they're the one union. So
We're all construction workers. Yeah. You know, we might be plumbers, there might be electricians. We all work in construction.
Yeah.
We all go and sit in the same sheds, work on the same site.
That's right.
None of us are actually better than anyone else.
Nah.
You know, the HSR on site, whether it's ours or someone else's, you know, takes the time to care about everybody on the job. It's an honourable thing, so really appreciate it.
You're on Stick Together, workers' stories, union news and social justice issues. Now we go to Victorio, a presenter on Radio Philip, Federation of Italian Migrant Workers and Families. Victorio's day job is as a workers' compensation lawyer.
On the 15th of October this year, we remembered the Westgate Bridge collapse. That's 55 years since Victoria's worst workplace accident. And a week earlier than that, we remember the Vaiont Dam tragedy, Italy's worst man-made disaster. I use these terms, such as accident, tragedy, and disaster, interchangeably. But the reality is that these were crimes. These were crimes of negligence and total disregard of human life in the pursuit of profit. The Vaiont Dam tragedy happened on the 9th of October 1963 in the northern Italian province of Belluno. It remains one of the worst man-made tragedies in the world. Almost 2,000 lives were lost, with some estimates at 2,500. When a large landslide fell into the artificial lake created by the dam, causing a massive tidal wave to crash over the dam wall and completely destroy the town of Longarone and surrounding villages in the valley below, killing all inhabitants. Hundreds of families were killed, with no survivors to identify the dead. The towns of Erto and Casso, which are above the dam, whose inhabitants had been resisting its construction for years, were also significantly destroyed, and there were hundreds killed. Over 600 bodies were never found. Traditions, histories, memories were lost in an instant. The local area today has still never recovered. This wasn't a disaster of natural causes. It was a crime of greed and corruption. The Vaiont Dam was the tallest dam in the world when it was built, at just over 261 metres high. It was a so-called engineering marvel. It still stands today as a reminder of the ruling class's callous pursuit of profit and disregard for human life. The dam was built in the second half of the 1950s by the Società Adriatica dell'Elettricità, or SADA, a period when many dams were built in the Belluno province at the expense of the local population. Large tracts of land were expropriated for these arrogant endeavours, and thousands of people were displaced. Such is the case of many of the valleys around the area, including that of a town, Rocca d'Arcie, whose population was reduced from 3,000 to 500 in a matter of years, as most of the village and almost all the fertile land that had sustained life for millennia was expropriated and then subsumed by the waters. Promises of jobs, compensation, and incentives were never kept, and the people were forced to leave. These people were poor montanari, or mountain people, and contadini, peasants. Their lives were marked by poverty and hardship. They had just experienced the brutal German occupation of 1943-45, and despite offering to the new Italian Republic a resistance that the Germans described as the fiercest in all of the Western theatre of war, they were treated as an afterthought in the post-war reconstruction. The company responsible, along with the Italian government that nationalised the project months before the disaster, was the Monopoly SADA. It was founded and owned by Conte Giuseppe Volpi, once the finance minister of fascist Italy. He was one of those typical members of the Italian ruling class who escaped any punishment for their role during the fascist period. Chameleons who turned from black to red to save their own skin. A number of concessions to build these dams were obtained during the fascist period, and the license obtained to build the Vaillant Dam was cooked up in the chaos of late 1943, when there existed no real government at all, and the quorum required for such decisions was not met. None of this mattered after 1945. The project had the backing of the government, and the electricity was needed to power the emerging industries of the Triveneto area, that's in northeastern Italy. During the 1950s, Sada began expropriating land in the townships of Erto and Casso, which lie exactly where the dam and basin would be built, with the aid of the new Italian state, forcing locals to sell for a pittance. Indeed, Sada operated like a state within a state, such was its influence and power. Jobs were offered on the dam project that locals had little option but to accept. Many of these workers would be injured or killed in the industrial accidents during its construction. Opposition grew quickly from the locals, and a committee for the defense of the mountain was formed. But the locals were not only concerned with losing their land, they also had well-founded fears about the safety of the project. They knew the land better than anyone else. They knew that Monte Toc, which towered over the valley, was not stable and a landslide was inevitable. Indeed, the name of the mountain, Toc, in local dialects, have several meanings. It can mean a piece, or it can mean crazy, it can even mean rotten. These fears were also shared by a number of geologists and engineers who had raised alarm only to be disregarded by Sada. Nothing could stand in the way of the progress and pursuit of profit. The locals were supported only by the Partito Comunista Italiano, or the PCI, PCI, and in particular the courageous PCI member and journalist for the party's newspaper L'Unità, Tina Merlin, who for years had documented their struggle and wrote articles condemning the project, predicting such a catastrophe. Tina Merlin understood the people of Erto and Casso. She herself was a Bellunese, a child of these very mountains, with a determination and tenacity learnt during the struggles of the partisan resistance which she joined some 20 years prior at the age of 17. Her warnings, like those of the geologists and engineers, were ignored. She was dismissed as both a woman and a communist. She was even sued, along with the newspaper L'Unità, by Sada, for spreading false news in relation to her articles about the dangerous project. She was eventually acquitted as the court found the fears were well-founded and the risk was imminent. But this changed little. Sada cared only for profit and had the support of the ruling anti-communist Democristiani government, the Christian Democrats. In 1961, the warnings grew as a landslide happened, but this landslide was not large enough to cause concern, even though one worker inspecting the dam was killed. Despite this, Sada sought to raise the dam's height and water level as this would increase their profits leading up to the nationalisation of the hydroelectric plants in 1963. In the months leading up to 9th of October 1963, there were more warning signs. Tremors and movement were noted on Monte Toc, with measurements of land moving as fast as 60 centimetres a day. The warnings were of an imminent landslide. Sada and then Enel, the national electricity company that had recently acquired the project, knew this. As the imminent disaster had become certain, their engineers had been gathering each night to witness the landslide and wave. In the days leading up to the 9th of October, the situation worsened further and the warnings grew. Despite these many warnings and even recommendations to authorities to evacuate the surrounding towns, nothing was done. Documents were falsified and the most disturbing warnings were deleted from the technicians' reports, with the regional government being assured that any landslide that could occur would only cause minor damage. At 10:39 p.m., the inevitable happened. A large section of Monte Toc, over 260 cubic metres, crashed into the lake, causing a tidal wave over 200 metres high to crash down into the valley below. Within minutes, Longarone and the surrounding villages were wiped off the map, along with all inhabitants. Few people would be pulled from the waters and rubble alive. Up on the mountain, the towns of Erto and Casso were also devastated, with hundreds killed. In the weeks and months that followed, the Italian press lined up to support the government and the company responsible. They led a campaign attacking the survivors and the PCI, who had supported them for years, and continued this support after the tragedy. The PCI, the PCI, the Italian Communist Party, sent members to help locals and campaign for justice. Many of these party members were partisans who had fought in the region and on the now infamous Monte Toc, and they had friends and strong connections to the area. The anti-communist Christian Democrat government accused them of being agitators and ran a campaign that the disaster was a natural phenomenon or God's will with no human error. What ensued was a cover-up, with evidence and reports being concealed by Enel and the government. The Italian Communist Party continued the campaign for justice, pressuring the government to compensate the victims and prosecute those responsible. The then Prime Minister and leader of the Christian Democrats, Giovanni Leone, promised to bring justice to the victims. However, only a few months later, after he lost the election, he joined Sada's team of lawyers, becoming the head of their legal team, and worked to reduce the amount of compensation for survivors. In the years that followed, Sada and Enel pressured survivors to accept meagre amounts of compensation. Many had to accept as they had little else to survive on. Court proceedings followed, and eventually, despite the government's attempted cover-up, the flaws in the project and disregard of the warnings were proven. Engineers of Sada and Enel were prosecuted. However, the trial was moved to the city of L'Aquila, which is hundreds of kilometres away, preventing participation from the locals and resulted in lenient sentences for only a few of the accused. It wasn't until 1997 that the last of the court proceedings resolved when Mont Edison, the company which has acquired Sada, was ordered to compensate the affected communities. The Italian government used the aftermath of the destruction to fund the reconstruction not only of the local area but the broader Veneto region. The so-called Vaillant Law established that every citizen of the disaster area holding a license for business, that's commercial, handicraft or industrial, at the time of the tragedy had the right to a 20% non-returnable contribution to restart their business, an 80% mortgage at lower than market rates for 15 years, at times when inflation's peaked up to 15%, and tax relief for 10 years. The law also stated that those who could not or did not want to reopen their old activities had the right to sell their license, and the buyer would receive the same rights on condition that their business activity was opened in the Veneto region. Few could continue their businesses and were quickly approached by large and small enterprises and entrepreneurs looking to cash in on the scheme. Of course, they were not told what they would be selling away. Some examples of the predatory behavior include companies being rewarded with ongoing government financing in the tune of billions of lire, the Italian currency at the time, for decades to come. In fact, this consequence was included in the law to see continuous refinancing for the companies that swindled the few remaining survivors. In this way, the Vaillant tragedy was transformed into a fortune for the burgeoning industrial capitalist class. The continued injustice does not even take into account the many cases of fraud that followed, with tales of missing funds gathered through charity that never reached a single survivor. Even from the billions of funding paid to the local municipality, nothing was spent to fulfill the wishes of the survivors to retrieve the 451 people that were still reported missing in the bed of the Maya Creek, or where the bodies of the 158 victims of Erto and Casso had been buried up above. We remember the tragedy of Vaillant first and foremost to pay respect to those that died and their surviving families, but we also remember this tragedy for the crime that it was, a crime of the arrogance, greed and corruption of the capitalist ruling class and the governments that support them. This is a story too often told, one of greed and corruption in the pursuit of profit at the expense of safety and lives of common people. You'd hope that people would learn, that governments would learn from these tragedies, but there's an added relevance for today where another dam project is proposed for a nearby valley in the Valle del Vanoi. This valley has a similar dangerous geological profile to that of Monte Toc. Now, fortunately, this project seems likely that it will not proceed, as a growing opposition to it has united all sides of politics in the area, and it's also opposed by the neighbouring provincial government of Trentino. There are also parallels that we can draw to the plan to build a bridge from Calabria to the island of Sicily across an area that's prone to earthquakes and where there is resistance among the local population. These stories must be told and these people must be supported.
You're on Stick Together, workers' stories, union news and social justice issues. We now go under the Westgate Bridge, which 55 years ago was the site of Australia's worst industrial accident to date, when the bridge collapsed, killing 36 workers. Part of the horror of that day, the 15th of October 1970, was the ultimate push by workers and their unions for a say in workplace safety laws. Today we hear from Ralph Edwards, former national president of the CFMEU, who used his time at the Westgate Bridge disaster commemoration this year to outline the important place unions have for bringing workers' concerns to the table.
...of collective action to give working people a direct say in their working lives. Not simply accept the dictate of employers and governments. We are entitled to feel pride in our achievements, in improving every aspect of our working lives. And we should expect and feel confidence that trade unionism and collective action will continue to be an integral part of our society. But there's always a but. As union membership continues to decline, while trade unionism does not seem ingrained in our society, where our communities are fragmented and often despairing, change has been relentless in the last 55 years, and the knock-on effects hit everybody. The media and the politicians pile on attacks on unions and their members. People in unions are accused, but not charged or found guilty of anything. And yet, when Qantas is found guilty of crimes against their employees in the TWU, they pay the fines and get on with business, and their bottom line is barely affected. There is one rule for some and another rule for others, for sure. There is a general sense of powerlessness and pending irrelevance for many in the trade union movement. If we are to continue the good work of trade unions, and most importantly, defend what has been achieved, then perhaps the time has come to stop. Review where the union movement is and start a conversation about the future and the strategies needed to maintain collective action and its embodiment in trade unions. There was, late last year, a conference, Unions for Democracy, to prepare for what might come out of the election. That momentum was started by the ETU, and we need to keep it moving. We need everyone to be part of the conversation. Rank and file members need to put their heads up and say what they want and need. Officials need to have an ongoing, direct conversation with their rank and file. And the upper echelons of the movement need to be accountable and spend less time just talking to government and corporate Australia, and therefore becoming co-opted into their preferred outcomes. Being on boards and managing our super money without consultation and endorsement is not trade unionism. Only recently, problems at the airport with whether people were under EBAs, whether people were receiving proper wages and conditions like other people at the airport, became a media story. And yet, the airport is owned in three parts, as I understand it. Macquarie Bank, don't expect much from them. The Australian Government's Future Fund, under the chairmanship of an ex-secretary of the ACTU. And third, Industry Funds Management. That's our super money, invested so that we get a decent retirement. And the chairman is an ex-assistant secretary of the ACTU. Helped write the Fair Work Act, and her husband works for the CFMEU administrator. Why should we be having arguments about safety, wages and conditions, superannuation or anything else when we put our money in that organisation and we should be there for more than just the return? We need a conversation that not only produces strategies for the future, we need to produce an active, effective and independent trade union movement. One that can talk to government, corporate Australia and bosses directly, pushing the interests of members, not accepting the agendas of government and employers, nor accepting responsibility for their failures in a society we do not control and have a limited say in. And we need to use our collective strength to ensure we can control all aspects of our working lives. Re-establish direct collective action as not only justified, but a right of all working people. This role for trade union needs the active support of our rank and file members. And this fight will give hope to our children and grandchildren in the future, but it will also reinvigorate the existing workforce at a time when I suggest the movement is not crumbling, but is slowly bleeding out. When I was about 13, I collected a little cartoon, The Wizard of Inn. And the cartoon involves the peasants standing below the battlements complaining about the injustice of society. And the king turns to Sir Rodney and says, "Never forget the golden rule. Them that makes the gold make the rules." Well, in this city, over 170 years, the trade union movement has not accepted that. We've said we want a say, we deserve a say, we must have a say in the rules. So do not despair. Trade unionism has faced many defeats in the last 170 years, but has always come back and fought the fight for justice and compassion. Let us decide where we are and where we can go, and let us control our relevance and therefore our future and the future of working people in this city. The challenge is as it has always been. Nothing changes, but we have had many victories and we are continuing the fight. It's all summed up in a phrase or two. Dare to struggle, dare to win. If you don't fight, you lose. Thank you very much for your attention.
That's it for Stick Together this week. If you want to catch up with our program, the podcast is available at 3cr.org or your favourite podcast site. Contact the producers of the show at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com or by giving us a call on 9419 8377 and leaving us a message. My name's Annie McLaughlin. Remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there is a union for you. Until next time, stick together and keep safe.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.